You're listening to World Oil's Deep Dive, where you'll get to know the authors of technical articles in World Oil magazine and learn more about their company's technology and how it's shaping our industry. Now, here's your host, Jim Watkins.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Here's another exciting episode live from OTC this year. And now we're on the oil state stand. I have with me my sidekick, Craig Fleming.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for the introduction, man.
Thanks for speaking into the mic, Craig, when I throw it to you like that. That helps a lot, man. That's a good deal.
I was giving it a good pause.
Craig, what do you do for World Oil?
I'm the technical editor for World Oil. I primarily edit and solicit articles from companies like Oil States for publication and marketing communications purposes.
So anybody who's doing anything with us is probably going to end up talking to you at some point as far as content for the magazine and website and all that stuff.
Yes. Right? One form or another.
All right.
We'll have some contact with them.
All right.
For sure.
Well, this is going to be fun because we don't get to do them together. I think this is the first one we've done together, isn't it, Craig?
It's a great idea, Jim.
All right. And here we're with Tom Robertson. Tom, welcome back, man. This is like we're going to catch up because we were here last year. So
Las Vegas OTC, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell everybody to go back and listen to that episode too. But fill in the folks, what is it you're doing here?
So I'm the Managed Pressure Drilling Project Manager for Oil States of our Heartlands facility in Scotland. Yeah, when I'd spoken to you last year, I was still working within the engineering department developing the joint. So
right. And that was award-winning technology last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, last year's OTC, we won the Spotlight Award on new technology for that.
Nice.
MPD joint, yeah.
Nice. And also, you have Graham Morrison here. You guys work together, right?
Good afternoon. Yes, we do. I'm the manager for Capital Drilling Equipment, also based in our Heartlands facility in the UK.
All right.
So it's great to be here today. Thank you for having us.
No, it's excellent. Excellent to catch up again and to find out what's going on in the MPD world.
Yep.
I don't have very many intelligent questions, but our technical editor, he has the most intelligent questions, Craig. So let's find out what's going on.
Well, Tom, you know, MPD's been around for quite a while. What is it that you're doing that is special and different, and what applications are you using it in?
So we're able to take, or we've done a kind of study into what the previous joints out there on the market were doing and what customers wanted them to do better. We spent about 4 or 5 years developing those joints and really focusing on those key aspects that customers wanted. And that's what we believe we've created with our MPD joint. So we've been able to create a joint that's overall around 40 feet in length. It's about 50% lighter as well, and being around 20 tons in weight. Some of the Generation 1 joints out there are kind of double that. So yeah, it's a massive improvement in performance for our MPD joint. We're also able to, through our extensive experience in the recertification of existing riser connections, we're able to customize these joints to suit whatever the client's needs are. So we can integrate this into almost any kind of rig offshore.
Yeah. So you guys actually have some of these things going in the field now, right? Since last year. Because last year there were none, right? It was still in its, I mean, it was launched, but there were none out.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So we've got one just now that is heading down to Australia for a contract. And that is almost completed. So yeah, it's going through its manufacturing stages at the moment. It'll be tested within the next few months and then down to get the first joint wet. So that's a great bit of news, yeah.
That'll be exciting. You'll have to give Craig an article on that afterward once you start getting some data back, right?
Yeah, it'd be good to get that. Yeah, be good to get some performance reviews on that and see how it's performing in the field, yeah.
Yeah. So what have you been doing in the meantime? So now you got this, it's shipping to Australia, you got that going. So now you can take a vacation? Well, I mean, what are you doing now?
Not quite, yeah. Yeah, it's the continuation of more joints to come, so.
Ah, okay. So still developing now, right? Working on iterations or whole new ideas?
Yeah, so it'll be just different iterations depending on customer requirements. So yeah, as I said, we can take whatever application the customer needs and we can try and custom design a joint to suit that application. So that'll be the future and definitely the focus for us, yeah.
Yeah. And so Graham, you sit over that. The MPD part is just a part of what you're in charge of, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how does that fit in? Does having an MPD, award-winning MPD technology, does that really help your efforts to help clients? I mean, are they excited about, look at Oil States, they're innovating, they're bringing good technology to us, that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been very well received with all our customers. We deal with them extensively in the capital drilling equipment, so bringing this new technology is really exciting both for us and for the market.
Nice. And so what areas are most active right now for you?
Yeah.
Geographically.
I mean, globally, we're really a big focus on the Gulf of Mexico at the moment, particularly on MPD. So we're really tackling that market. Another area we see a lot of potential for growth is in Turkey. So we're focusing a lot of effort on developing systems and services for that region.
So offshore has been the main focus, if I understand correctly. Do you see any more drive for the onshore application?
The focus for my area is certainly on the offshore side of things, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. So is that a division within Oil States that it's mostly, I mean, when you guys talk MPD, because they do have MPD on shore too, right? But that's a different group for you guys, or you guys don't touch it?
We don't touch it. We see the opportunities for the technology we have on the offshore market. It's maybe somewhat a saturated market, the onshore. So we see the opportunities there in the offshore side of things, at least initially.
Awesome. Craig, any other exciting deep questions?
What are the main challenges that customers are using MPD for? Have it changed over the years?
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is I think MPD really was brought on to drill the undrillable. But as customers have used that more over the years, it's becoming more and more used on standard wells because it's just improving efficiencies across the board. So we really are seeing an increase in the requirement for MPD. So yeah, as I say, it's going to be exciting for us moving forward. One of the things, just to touch on that, that's interesting about the deployment down to Australia is that they came to us and challenged us with designing a very much a unique system. So they're looking to utilize one of the older semi-submersible vessels. So this is one of the moored vessels with a smaller rotary table. This is the 49.5-inch rotary. So they challenged us with taking our standard joint and reconfiguring it to actually fit through this smaller rotary table. Now, we were able to do this by reconfiguring the design, and we believe it's the only one in the market that's able to achieve this. So it's exciting both for us and for the market because we believe it's going to open up a whole new opportunity for drilling contractors to potentially utilize some of these older vessels for MPD operations.
Yeah, and that's a key thing, right? Because having a state-of-the-art or new vessel out, that's quite expensive. And if you can install some of this equipment on an older vessel or using an older vessel, that's a game changer, right?
Yeah, we think so, yeah.
Yeah. Craig?
Anything before we wrap up here? Any forward-looking statements or what you see for the future, what you got going, what's coming out, what your customers are asking for?
Yeah, the key thing for us is actually deploying this joint. And if it performs the way we absolutely expect it to, we just expect the opportunities to continue. We really do.
Yeah.
So we're excited about that. And yeah, we look forward to getting these joints wet and in the field.
Well, I'm telling you, that is prime material for the readers of World Oil, right, Craig?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What's new and upcoming and what you're doing to increase efficiencies and get the well drilled, hopefully any less carbon footprint you guys got coming up you can discuss?
Yeah, we're certainly from the facility point of view, we're looking at different options there to improve it. We're bringing in solar panels. We're looking at efficiencies across the board.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you use that? Can you get enough juice off of solar panels?
It's hard to believe in Scotland, but
yeah, you'd think wind would be better out there,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
But no, that's interesting. That's interesting. So definitely, I know this is the third time I'm saying it, but it is absolutely true. Once you guys start getting some numbers back, connect with Craig and definitely get that information out to our readers.
Yeah, we will.
Tom, Graham, thanks for being on the show. Craig, anything else before we wrap this one up?
I think we're good.
All right, Craig.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Still here. Another episode live from OTC with my counterpart, Craig Fleming. Craig, good to see you again.
Hey, Jim. Great to be here, man. Thanks for the invite.
My pleasure. What do you do for World Oil?
I'm the technical editor of World Oil, or responsible for soliciting articles, editing them, and getting them published, and facing with people like Oil States here to make sure we get their latest technology out in front of the clients and customers.
That's awesome. I'm glad you're here, because we're going to talk to Patrick McKeever about some award-winning technology, right? Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us on. And yeah, we were the recipients of this year's Spotlight Award for our active seat gate valve. Really excited about it, and just looking forward to talking to you guys.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me, because when I heard that you won that award, and then they showed me that, I'm not a valve master, I don't know about valves, I was like, looks like a gate valve, you know? So let's get into it. I think Craig's got some questions for you, and we're going to find out more about this, what makes this different.
Great.
You know, Patrick, fracking's been going on a long time. I'm just wondering what makes your active seat gate valve so significant and what it's doing for the customers.
Well, we might have not been the most creative guys in the market when we came up with a name for it, but it is an active seat. And the seat is essentially providing bilateral force or bidirectional force on the pocket and the gate itself. So essentially, because this is happening on both sides of the gate, we no longer have symmetrical pressure. We have pressure coming in that's able to seal the valve cavity off and essentially isolate it. So that's doing a tremendous amount of things as far as providing benefits to the customer, but namely, it's keeping the grease in the valve. And by doing that, we're not allowing anything to intrude on the valve, so we're not seeing any sand migration, fluid migration through that cavity any longer, which is causing downtime, causing valve failure on location. We've simply eliminated all of those things. And so at this point, we're looking at 100% success rate with all the trials and all the actual field time for this valve. It's something we're extremely proud of and happy to get out to the market as it's available.
Nice. Well, tell us something about that, about the field time. So obviously you did all the bench testing, you got that out with some clients and stuff. So how much time has it seen?
Yeah, so we're not going to measure it in years because there's so much research time that's involved in it. But right now we're sitting over 15,000 stages with billions of pounds of sand pumped through these valves.
Wow.
And zero failure.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's really provided a solution to our customers that, you know, I think the industry was needing. And so we occupy that space now and we're happy to have it in our belt.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Good deal. Thanks, Patrick. What distinguishes the active seat gate valve from previous offerings and what your competitors are putting on the market?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, a standard valve coming to market just simply does not have the ability to seal the way that the active seat does. And the seal in the pocket itself is proprietary to Oil States. And so what we've done essentially is, once again, we've isolated those cavities where we were having all the issues, which was the root of all failures for these valves. And so now that we've eliminated out of the equation, we're just at a point now to where it's kind of running on its own. And before, you would see greasing intervals somewhere between 3 and 5 stages. We've extended that to 40 stages and beyond.
40 stages?
40 stages.
Wow. Wow.
And that's by design. We could go longer, but we like to keep the maintenance aspect of the valves alive on location and keep that all the way through the process from delivery to post-production.
Right. Now, do you have this problem? Because, you know, I talk to a lot of people about different technologies. Did your clients really believe that they could keep it through going through 40 stages, or were they just standing around waiting for it to fail? Were they like,
even with the best sales pitch, I don't think anybody believed it until they saw it work. I think that goes across the board, you know, even internally. Of course, we believe in the team and their efforts on the engineering level. But once you see this thing in action and it's offsetting years and years of failures and pain points for the industry, it really was something to see, and the data set that goes along with it has been really impressive. And it's fun to sell, it's fun to get out in front of the customers, and it's just one of those processes that makes the entire sell to ticket much easier to deal with.
Yeah, because it kind of seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, wouldn't you, Craig? I mean, if you were in charge of tech and you saw something like that, you'd be like, hey, why not?
That sounds like a great technology, Patrick. You spoke of the benefits. Can you expand on the value that you're providing to the customers?
Well, the value, I mean, it transcends beyond just we're saving grease on location. I mean, a lot of people run a lot of different models economically speaking, but, you know, at the end of the day, whenever I don't have to concern my customer with getting a post-job damage ticket, that's huge, right? Nobody right, likes those. Yeah. We don't like giving them out. So we don't concern ourselves with abnormal wear. And I'd like to throw that into quotation marks because it's abnormal, right? It's outside of the function of a normal operation on the valve. And these things just do not happen anymore. You know, it's as sure of a deal as we've ever been able to provide to the market in that space. And so that's one of the key functions of it. The second part of it is less grease means less need to grease on location. And when we have less need to grease, that occupies a few different spaces. Obviously, you have some HSE issues that can come with over-greasing, but also production of the well. I mean, nobody's come out and directly wrote a paper on what this grease is doing to your perforations, but I can tell you this, nothing ever came good of putting foreign material in the well.
Right, exactly.
And if we're putting less than what everyone else is putting in there, that's got to be a good thing, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So you spoke of how many basins or a lot of runs. Are you active in all the U.S. basins? Or
not at this time.
Canada?
So it's been relative slow rollout. You know, this was post-COVID, so development was during COVID. We dealt with supply chain constraints, of course. But we've rolled out. We're in the Bakken, the DJ Basin, Permian, and the Haynesville currently. Mm-hmm. We're starting in the Marcellus this month with the valve.
And you mentioned supply chain issues. Is that still a problem? I mean, is
sure.
still difficult to get
it's,
in?
Obviously, it's not as imposing as it once was, but right. Yeah, we still see it from time to time, depending on what it is. But I think we've done pretty good with our management portion of getting in front of that, understanding what we need, and logistically speaking, having just-in-time deliveries for the things that we really need to make sure these valves are able to be put together and deployed.
Yeah, because that's a problem, right? When you get a really hot product and it gets going, then, you know, keeping up with demand can be a real, real problem.
No doubt.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So what are the real takeaways? I mean, what do you want to leave with your customers, potential customers from this discussion? What do they need to know?
Yeah. So once again, I mean, we've eliminated sand migration into the valve. And the way that we did that was we isolated the grease cavity, right? We're reducing the amount of grease that's required for the valve by up to 85% per job. We're keeping the valves from having any kind of damages outside of what we would call normal damages, which we account for on the front end of every ticket. So no more post-job damage tickets, which is huge for the companies that we work for. And then on top of that, I mean, like I said, it's as close to a sure deal that we can give to the industry right now. And it's been 100% success rates, hard to argue with.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. So, yeah, if you need to look at your gate valves and you want to go more stages without greasing and all of that, you got to give Oil States a call. They can do it. Craig, anything else you needed to add before we go?
I think every marketing guy wants to know, is there a Gen 2 coming down the line?
Well, when Gen 1's as good as this is, I don't know that Gen 2's anywhere in the pipeline.
100% is pretty good.
Wait. Did you guys work that out, man? That was a little like soft pitch.
You know, Craig and I had a little backroom discussion. You know, there might have been some exchanges. I can't really say for sure.
It was at the bar.
It was at the bar.
All right, Patrick. Well, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for
having me. This sounds fantastic. No wonder you won the award. Sounds like you deserve every bit of that. And, you know, some papers, right? Again, I mean, you know, for the magazine, this is what, I mean, you need to get that news out to clients. That's what we do best.
Sure. So, yeah, we've laid the foundation for some case studies. We'll have those out as soon as we can get them out. And we're just really excited to get the word out.
Excellent, Patrick. All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Continuing on with our episodes live from OTC, here with our technical editor from World Oil, Craig Fleming.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for the introduction. Pleasure to be here with you and Oil States today.
Yeah, isn't this fun? I mean, at OTC, there's a lot of action, a lot of stuff going on, right?
This is a good part of OTC, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm enjoying it.
Yep. And like you said, today we're here with Oil States and we're here with Brian Mizell. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
How many times have you been on the show, man? It seems like you're on the show like all the time.
Well, we were here through the downturn when nobody else showed up. So I guess it was you and I, Jim, back then, and we were waving the flag. So we're back again and glad to be here.
Exactly. Brian, for our audience, explain to folks what you do. What's your day job here at Oil States?
So within our group, we have a couple different functions, which includes our marketing, business development, most recently some of our investor activities.
Investor activities too? Oh, that's high stress, man.
Oh, it's good. It's good. We've got a lot to be excited about, a lot to counteract of storylines out there in the market, but companies performing well. Good, solid track record financial performance. But beyond that, got a strong underpinning of our technology that's really helping us to map out an extended runway of potential opportunities going forward.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we were talking with Patrick an episode ago, right? And that's amazing award-winning technology. And you guys won another award this year too, right? Tell us about that.
That's right. The second Spotlight Award that we won this year was for our FTLP, our floating wind platform design, which has been released now into the market. And is really designed for mid-water depths in the floating wind market to address some of the opportunities that we see out there.
Okay. Craig, do you know anything about floating wind?
Very little, but the first thing that comes to my mind with a name like Oil States, why would you guys be getting into a wind
technology? That's a good question.
Well, that's a great question. And as a marketing guys, we had to obviously address that issue. You know, we can't exactly sell into the renewables market with that type of name, but we do have a subsidiary venture that we've called OSI Renewables. We also have another one for the Deep Sea Minerals group for OSI Minerals.
Oh, I love that thing.
But yeah, like you said, Oil States name could be a little bit problematic, but we've got an umbrella in which flag and under which we fly with this product line. And so we've seen some good reception in the market.
So have you guys been developing that, you know, for wind, whether fixed or floating or whatever? Have you been doing that for a while? I mean, that's like an easy thing to get into, right? There's a lot of...
No, it's definitely not been an overnight deal. And I think part of that stems from the legacy and the foundation that Oil States has. As you know, Oil States has been around in the deep water market for over 40 years. The company's over 80 years old. And so certainly a lot of offshore experience in that. So what we're looking at doing, and this really stems from our view on the market overall and our view on energy in the totality of it, but we see that the energy market requires a mix of all the different sources,
right. Really.
We support both the traditional oil and gas side of things, but also now on the alternative energy side. And the reason for that being, if you look at even macro level, of course, energy demand is continuing to grow around the world, global population growth, so on, per capita requirements continue to grow. And even if you go back, there's some others, our peers in the industry have really looked at this. Even going back to the 1800s, quite intriguing.
Wow.
Where we were all burning wood and coal, and then the evolution of hydrocarbons and so on. But you'll see that even today that over 83% of the world's requirements are met through hydrocarbons. And so,
yeah, of course. Yeah.
It really is the cornerstone and foundation to a lot of the economic prosperity and things that we enjoy today. That said, you know, if you look at the mix today, you know, all the additions of solar and wind, geothermal, all these things, these are all things that we're looking at as a company. But it all comes back to how do we apply the traditional technologies of oil and gas to the renewables markets.
Right.
And that's where we're seeing a lot of opportunity here. Historically, oil states supplied over 95% of the tendon mooring systems for all the tension led platforms for the oil and gas industry.
95%?
That's right.
Wow.
So that includes the complete moorings package, which is the seabed connections all the way up to the top structure and all the connections in between. So what we've done is we've taken that Merlin connection technology and then we've looked at how can we apply that to the floating wind market. Now, so within the wind market, as you know, most of that's developed in the shallow water initially.
Right.
And that's 50 meters or less, usually fixed platform equipment. We've supplied over 50 renewables projects to date, both on the fixed platform side of our business, as well as some other guys in our Riser Tech division that do global analysis and engineering type work. But beyond that, we looked at there's kind of a gap between that and the ultra deep water type installations.
Right.
When you get in beyond 50 meters, it's really not economical to install a jacket for wind. So what we tried to do was look at how could we address that market. Now, if you jump straight to a more of a deep water solution for TLP, there's a lot of problems there, a lot of limitations, one of which is the amount of steel, the fabrication,
right,
the weight, even quayside and port restrictions and drafts on the quayside in order to be able to install, let's say, 200 turbines in an array.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And then you get into questions of, one of the things that we've been asked, and I think you guys were talking about, was why would oil states get into this type of market? And when we look at it, there's significant opportunity out there. I think Westwood Energy has predicted that over the next 7 years, there's going to be over 26,500 turbines that are installed globally.
Wow, wow. That's a lot.
That's a significant opportunity for us. But you do start to get into the challenge of that, which is, you know, how are you going to build a supply chain for those kinds of things?
Right. Right, because it's so different from your roots, right, where it's like, hey, we're just building this one platform and we're going to stick it out there. Like you said, when you got a bunch of those and you're trying to put them together, it's like a small floating island that you're trying to get off there, and that's a different dynamic. I mean, the most amazing thing to me, and I think we talked about this at the Floating Wind Solutions when we were over there, is that the ocean dynamics on a boat hull is one thing. On a platform, floating platform is something else. But you hook a bunch of floating platforms together, that's a whole different thing, right?
Right.
Stresses and craziness that, you know, you can never even think. I mean, I don't know. Somebody thinks of it, right? They got models and stuff.
That's right. That's right. We've looked at all the hydrodynamics of this system. That's one of the main features of the FTLP, was really looking at how could we create a stable system for the midwater environment.
Right.
That's going to reduce the amount of steel. I think in this case, it probably reduces by about 50%. And it has some unique.
How much,
features.
15 or 50?
50, 5-0.
5-0?
Right.
Would you use concrete instead or something, like in the old World War II?
No, there are some
things
out there that are looking concrete, gravity-based structures. We've looked at all the different alternatives, but really we thought we can apply this TLP-style technology to a different type of approach. And the way in which this works is that we call it an FTLP. It stands for sort of a fixed TLP, but it is for the floating market in those type of water depths. And the reason that that works is that the technology is based around a central compression column, which integrates our different connectors. That sort of creates the upward force that actually keeps the platform above the surface of the water. So rather than using buoyancy or some other mechanism to keep the platform elevated, in this case, the compression column in the center keeps the platform above the water, which mitigates any of the wave activity. Then beyond that, the stability, there's an inherent stability that's created by the tendon systems that also then moor that top structure to the seabed.
So it's like, I don't have a picture of it here in front of me, but like a table with one leg. It's like those high top tables, right? With the thing. And so
right,
it's taken up there. And then
and some mooring lines.
With some mooring lines. Yeah, exactly. To stabilize it, right? To keep it stable.
And
that's crazy, right, Craig? That's a crazy design.
The only thing I could get done a great job of outlining the deep history of oil states with the marine construction and the build up of your wind platform. Is there anything different that makes it from your competitors?
Well, we've not really seen anyone else out there that's taken this kind of approach to the midwater market in particular. You know, right now, as I said, a lot of the activity in wind has been in the shallow water. Once you get beyond that 50 meters or so water depth, there's really not an alternative that meets some of those challenges in a cost-effective way. So this system, again, it was designed to create a lightweight, modular, easily manufactured type system that can be deployed in those midwater depths to really get the cost per kilowatt hour, the LCOE, if you want to call it that, levelized cost of energy down to a level in which it's economic for those developers.
And Brian, so is that why it won an award? Because like nobody's developed something like this?
I think so. It's a unique technology. Primarily, initially, it was targeted towards some of the North Sea developments. You know, in Scotland, they're much further ahead than we are here in the U.S. projects and the leases in the Scott Wind areas, as well as NTOG that's coming up. Those are some areas that are progressing a little more quickly. We're also looking at East Coast, West Coast here in the U.S. As you might be familiar, on the East Coast, there are some water depths and some fields in which this could be applicable. West Coast tends to get deeper much quicker.
Right.
It probably pushes you more towards a traditional TLP-style floating structure. But there are some targeted areas in which this one would fit within the parameters of what would be needed. And I think the interesting thing, too, we've been, as you mentioned earlier, we've been developing this for a number of years, and it wasn't just something that happened overnight. So in the last several months, the last year or so, we've taken our system now to a TRL 6 in terms of the development, the technology readiness level. It's been tested with the University of Strathclyde in the UK, tank tested.
Right.
Where they've submitted it to all the
pressures and
the wave heights and things like that. And the interesting thing, we have a video, maybe we can put it out on social media or something like that, that everyone can see. But compare side by side a traditional floating TLP structure versus the FTLP. And if you look at the TLP structure, it's waving back and forth.
Right.
In the waves. And of course, that's an issue because the nacelle at the top, the blades are attached to, can be up to 1,000 tons. And you can imagine.
Yeah, you start getting some serious back and forth, right?
Millions of load cycles over a 20, 30 year lifespan is a lot of wear and tear on the turbines and maintenance required and so on. So now, if you look at the FTLP by comparison, I'll admit it's relatively boring. It's just sitting
there. It's just sitting there. Right?
And it moves less than a degree.
Less than a degree.
Declination. So it
wow.
Really eliminates the movement almost completely there.
So. That's cool. So has anybody incorporated this design to any of their projects yet? Or are you still talking with folks on that?
Yeah, we're at the stage where we've gotten now the tank testing done. We did several different design iterations. The most recent iteration, we did make some modifications to that. We added 3 more tendons to the system, which also improved the stability further. But now we're at the stage where we're in discussion with different potential partners to try to deploy a demo system, perhaps maybe a 2-megawatt system as the next target.
Yep.
Get something out in the water to where it's field proven. Obviously, developer is going to want to see that type of approach before they were willing to commit to a large-scale commercial deployment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think I sound like a broken record because I say this all the time. You know, once you get the data back, even though World Oil, right, Craig? I mean, that's kind of funny because you talk about oil states and World Oil talking about wind stuff, right? But it's true. We're covering it more for that same reason, right? Part of the energy mix, it all has to be there. But definitely do an article up for us. Tell us about, you know, the testing and those type of things. Once you get some full-scale data back, I'd be curious. But also, even before that, let us see that video, man. We'll put that up online for sure.
Yeah, we have a slot for wind technology.
Okay.
That we'd be happy to entertain an article from you.
Oh, that'd be great.
Awesome. Awesome. Craig, anything else before we go?
I think you and Brian have covered it very well. The only thing that comes to mind is what kind of market do you see this going forward and how involved is oil states going to get into it?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like I said, our primary targets are probably North Sea initially. We continue to work here in the U.S. and looking at potential opportunities. We're engaging with others like the Department of Energy and national laboratories that are working on some of these topics. And again, the next step is really to target that demo system, try to get something in the water and prove out that.
But you know this, Brian. I mean, there's a significant investment before any of this ever comes to fruition and you start doing it. So I know you guys have run the numbers internally. You had to. You don't have to share them with us, but if you can, what percentage do you think the wind market is going to be of revenue for oil states 5-10 years from now?
It's hard to predict 5-10 years from now, but right now our non-oil and gas related revenues are around 10% of the business. Obviously, we would see that potentially growing in the future. When we look at the renewables side of things, now that I should add a little caveat that includes both the renewables type activities as well as some military products that we supply here. So that's a bit of a mix outside of the oil and gas space. But going forward, I think we really talk about the fact that we see the potential for revenue really increasing 2025, 2026. Now that said, we've also made significant progress already in other areas like in the deep sea mineral systems, which we won the spotlight award last year.
I love
year,
that thing. I love that thing. That. Yeah.
And so there's been some interesting progress over the last year in that area as well. In fact, the system that we deployed through Allseas, and I believe with the end user of the metals company, and they're here tomorrow also giving a talk, so if folks want to stop by. But that system was recently successfully deployed in the middle of the Pacific in the Clarion-Clipperton zone. We believe, it hasn't been verified yet, but possibly to a world record water depth for a deep water riser system.
Wow.
So that's around 14,764 feet, around 4,000 meters. And so we haven't quite confirm that, but
yeah. And just to refresh the listener's memory, that's what I like to describe as the subsea vacuum cleaner system, right?
That's right.
Because it's a converted drill ship, right? With basically a vacuum cleaner hose and a thing that runs back and forth on the ocean floor and vacuums up rare earth minerals off of the floor, right?
That's right. Out there in the middle of the Pacific, there's thousands of square miles of these, what they call polymetallic nodules, full of high concentrations of cobalt, lithium, manganese, all the types of materials that you need for electric vehicle battery manufacturing. And as you hear in the media all the time, of course, the supply of rare earth minerals, especially from land-based sources, is fairly limited. Auto manufacturers these days, you know, the forecasted demand for growth in those types of vehicles can't meet the requirements for all the batteries that are required. And especially in areas of the world where there's issues with, well, social issues, let's say.
Exactly.
Have to be mitigated. And so there are concerns around the deep water harvesting of these polymetallic nodules. They look like black potatoes, by the way, just covering the
sea. Are they only potato size? I thought they were like bowling ball size.
No.
Are they potato size?
Like potato size.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Because the image, right? You guys had an image of them just like laying around. It looks like somebody just tossed them all on the floor of the ocean.
It's amazing that that resource is there and available. But there was a successful deployment, as I mentioned. The metals company in Allseas did a successful trial run this summer, or I guess it was last year, and they'll be presenting on that here at OTC. But they were able to retrieve quite a bit of those nodules successfully, continuing to test the system, making further improvements. We've also partnered with other companies on the pump system as well as the harvester subsea Hoover, as you called it,
vacuum cleaner, exactly.
That's an area that's already progressed, and we've sold the first two systems. I think, as far as I know, we're the only ones that have systems out there in the field right now, both for the Pacific, but as well as in Japan. And the difference there, of course, is that the international waters are governed by the International Seabed Authority, the UN, whereas other countries like Japan, the Cook Islands, Norway, so on, have these resources within their own territorial waters and progress the It's really the environmental framework that's the critical piece that needs to be sorted out.
Wow.
That always comes to my mind. Who owns that stuff in the middle in the deep water? You go get a lease from the UN to mine those minerals?
That's right.
Is that way it works?
So I suppose you and I could go out and get a lease if we wanted to. I don't know the requirements for it. But anyway, no, they've set boundaries to different areas like they would for leases in the Gulf of Mexico.
Wait, but so who gets that money? Does that money go to the UN? I mean, you pay for a lease. Who gets that money? Is it?
I don't know. That's... I'm not sure. That's crazy. Is the UN.
We have to do a deep dive on international water leases and find out exactly what's going on there, because it's true that there are resources out there that we're going to want to get a hold of, right?
Sure.
You guys are already working on it. But man, I can't believe everything that Oil States is into. I mean, you guys really an incredible, incredible company. So thanks a lot for taking time today, Brian, to talk to us. Craig, you have anything else to ask before we wrap it up?
Thanks, Brian.
That was great. Thank you so much, Greg.
Yes, sir.
Jim, good to see you guys again.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. Take a look at today's show notes for links we mentioned in the podcast. We enjoy your feedback, so if you have any questions or comments, email them to deepdive@worldoil.com. Check out worldoil.com for the best oil and gas industry technical articles and news. And join us next time for another Deep Dive with World Oil.